a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite.
Tonight, the police released their only suspect in the mass murder of film star Sharon Tate and four others.
Late last night, another bizarre murder in Los Angeles, the second in 2 days. The owner of a small supermarket chain found in his home, his head covered by a white hood, a meat fork stuck in his chest. His wife, 38-year-old Mrs. Lino LaBianca, found in the bedroom dead, her back brutally cut by a whip.
He's inside, two bodies outside.
They came and went, and the number varied from 20 to 30. Police said they were a pseudo-religious cult. People who worked on the ranch said they were heavy users of drugs.
Were lurid. The movie actress was Sharon Tate, 26. The others were a male hairdresser, the heiress to a coffee fortune, a writer, and a boy just out of high school.
A wandering band of members of a so-called religious cult with a leader they call Jesus has had three of its followers arrested in the investigation of the murder of Sharon Tate and six others. Those arrested are two women and one man, and the Los Angeles police said they would ask murder indictments against several others. Five women are being held as material witnesses.
They called themselves the family.
Los Angeles has had another multiple murder. Last night, a middle-aged couple was stabbed to death in a case that has striking similarities to the mass murder Saturday of actress Sharon Tate and four friends.
We're taking dope and stealing cars and they just sit around all day and sleep. And that's about it. And we went around collecting garbage and had that for dinner and went to the store once in a while. And that was about it. They just slept and got loaded.
People who lived with Manson on the ranch and in the desert denied that they were a violent group. They called themselves the family.
Who was playing? That's what the whole thing is, that we were doing out there was playing. You know.
Well, what kind of guy was Charlie?
He's a good person. Very good person. He's got a lot of peace.
Was he out there all the time?
I don't even know. You know, he'd take off over mountains, just like a deer.
In a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite.
On his body, the word war had been carved in the chest. Then, with blood, the killer had scrawled on the refrigerator door the words, death to pigs.
Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, best-selling author Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me once again as we prepare to take another look at Charles Manson's family. Now, before we get into the story proper for this week, I have my normal show plugs. If you'd like to follow me on social media, it'd be Instagram, Facebook, YouTube. Just search for either Ian Totten, author, or The Deathcast. You can also find me on Truth Media and Twitter under Corpse Creek. If you'd like to sign up for the show's official mailing list, you can go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com. While there, please consider clicking on the donate button. Buy me a cup of coffee or a pack of smokes. If you enjoy what it is I do, please consider subscribing wherever it is you get your favorite podcast. And please consider leaving a 5-star review. They really do help the show grow. If you're interested in checking out any of my written works, they can be found at tinyurl.com/totten-books. And if you're interested in becoming a Patreon of the Deathcast, you can go to tinyurl.com/DCPatreon. For as little as $2 a month, you can help offset the costs of producing this show. Lastly, if you are interested in advertising on this show that goes out to thousands of people a week and is routinely in the top 10% of all true crime podcasts worldwide, you heard me correct there. We're routinely in the top 10% of all true crime podcasts worldwide. Contact me at ian@corpsecreekpublishing.com. We can work something out. I have tremendous deals ranging from 2 weeks, 1 month, up to 90 days. All right, now that all of that is out of the way, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, kick back, relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last week, we were talking about Manson. We had just started touching on him. I brought the Polanski Tate family up to around 1967, and I started touching on Charles Manson. The reason for that is, in this general timeline of things, is really when Manson is going to come into the picture. Now, a disclaimer before I dive into everything having to do with Charles Manson. There are aspects of his life, as I've stated in the initial episode of this series, that I'm going to miss. Some of them I am going to leave out because I don't feel they're pertinent to tell this particular story. And others, I'm just not aware of it. Manson is one of those characters from the 20th century, one of those people who is so infamous he's actually become part of the pop culture lexicon. And as opposed to a Jimmy Savile, who I had spent, you know, really a decade studying, and I know pretty much every facet of his life that's out there, I'll be honest with you, I don't know every facet of every single thing that Manson did and said and was involved in. And his story is so convoluted because there has been such a wealth of research done on him that at times it's difficult to follow the timeline of events concerning him. So I'm going to do my best to touch on the key important aspects of his life. And again, if I leave something out that you really think is important that should be included in the show, please don't hesitate to reach out to me either via social media or through the website at ian@corpsecreekpublishing.com and let me know about it. If I look it up and find it to be true, I will include it, and I will also give you a shout-out on the show to thank you for bringing that particular piece of information to my attention. Charles Manson was born No Name Maddox on November 12, 1934, to a 15-year-old by the name of Kathleen Maddox at the University of Cincinnati Health Center. Now, you're going to see some things that list that his name at birth was Charles Miles Maddox. This is an untruth. In fact, you can find pictures of his birth certificate online that state quite clearly that upon birth, his unwed 15-year-old mother did not give him a name. It's thought by many researchers that Manson's biological father was a man by the name of Colonel Walker Henderson Scott Sr. What is known concerning this is that Manson's mother, Kathleen Maddox, filed a paternity suit against Colonel Scott. And it's also come to light that Scott worked intermittently at mills throughout Ohio. Scott was also known and thought to be a con artist. Maddox, that would be Manson's mother, initially believed that Scott was, in fact, an army colonel, although she eventually learned that this was, in fact, his given name. It makes you wonder how he was able to pull off this particular charade. I was in the military, and usually officers have some form of uniform. It lends itself more to the fact that his mother was more likely than not of low intelligence, and some people might take issue with me saying that, but you're going to see as we continue with his story, she was not the brightest nor the most upstanding of women. So Kathleen informs Scott that she's pregnant. He tells her he has to leave the area on business, and after a few months, she realizes that he is not coming back. So at this point, his mother hooks up with another man by the name of William Eugene Manson, who was about 10 years older than his mother, and she ends up marrying this Manson individual. And it's from this man, William Manson, who was a laborer at a dry cleaning business, that Manson was given both his last name as well as a first name. Manson's childhood almost, well, not almost, Manson's childhood from the very beginning was extremely turbulent. He never knew who his biological father was. His mother marries this William Manson individual, but it's pretty apparent almost right off the bat that she is not a fit mother. She's 15 years old when her son is born, and she is habitually going out and partying with her brother. Whereas some sites state going on drinking sprees with him. This left Manson with numerous babysitters. Some sources that I have read state that there's a belief that Manson may have been abused from a young age. However, again, like so many other things, it's hard to tell if this is fact or a fiction or something that people simply believe to be true. On April 30th of 1937, William Manson was granted a divorce from Kathleen, citing gross neglect of duty. That is open to interpretation as to what it means. It could mean that, you know, he grew tired of her not taking care of both their household and their son. It could also mean that she was uninterested in being a wife. It is known that at some point, at least eventually, Manson's mother would turn to prostitution. And it could simply be that she was out carousing, looking for Johns at this point, and her husband was aware of this, or knew that she was fooling around on him at the very least, and decided that that was enough and he was not going to continue with this sham of a marriage. So it's at this point that Manson's mother puts in for the paternity test against Colonel Scott, and eventually a judgment is issued in her favor. However, as all things Manson are, nothing is ever simple. On August 1st of 1939, so when Manson is just shy of turning 5 years old, his mother and her brother Luther are arrested for assault and robbery, and they end up getting convicted and sentenced to 5 to 10 years imprisonment. You can see at this point how tumultuous Manson's early years are. I've read some sources that state that prior to this, he was in and out of youth hostels, although the consensus seems to be that that is not the case. It is known that once his mother is arrested, he is sent to live with an aunt and uncle who live in McHenan, West Virginia. And according to Jeff Gunn, at this period of time Manson's living with the aunt and uncle, he starts going to school. Apparently he had a teacher who was fairly abusive of Manson. So again, we have these accusations of abuse in his early life. And it's known that during this period of time, Manson began to show signs of an antisocial personality disorder. he was seen as standoffish, pugnacious, did not listen well to authority, and the first seeds of his truancy began to be shown. In 1942, Kathleen was paroled from prison. Manson later characterized his mother's return from prison as the happiest period in his life. As with all things Manson, though, nothing lasts forever. She ends up moving herself and son to Charleston, West Virginia. And really, at this point, it's where his mother's drinking, which had already been an issue, takes off. She spends her evenings drinking and looking for clients, while Manson is really left to fend for himself. And at this point, he starts stealing little things from stores. Again, his mother is arrested, this time for committing grand larceny, which is basically stealing a significant amount of property that is equal to at least $400, in some states up to $1,000. Again, Manson was kind of singled out during his early years because he wasn't a big child. In fact, I believe Manson only ever attained a height of about 5 foot or 5'3", somewhere in between there. So he was a little individual. And he was continually picked on by the other children in the neighborhoods that they lived in. At some point after his mother's arrest for grand larceny, which she was not convicted of, the family moved to Indianapolis, where, according to an article on Medium, she began dating a man by the name of Lewis, who she met through an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And according to Manson himself, when he was 9 years old, he sets his school on fire. Although, again, there really is no way to tell whether or not this actually happened. What is known about this period of time in his life is that he really began to get into trouble for truancy and petty theft. So much so that at the age of 13 in 1947, he was placed in the Gibault School for Boys in Terre Haute, Indiana. It has been said that the Gibault School was rife with abuse by priests, that it was an extremely strict place where the smallest of infractions would result in the students being beaten with rulers as well as with paddles. I'm going to take it a step further, just from what I know about Manson as well as about the Catholic Church at this period of time, and posit that there's a very good possibility that there may have been some form of sexual abuse taking place at this school, as it is well known that Catholic Church liked to send priests who, quote-unquote, had a problem with boys to places such as this to get them away from the general population. And schools back then, particularly these times of schools, were the perfect place to get them out of public view, and let's be honest, for the most part, states were really not concerned with what was happening to the boys in these institutions during this period of time. There are thousands upon thousands of documented cases from this era up into the 1970s in the U.S. alone of major league sexual abuse taking place. So it's a very good possibility that Manson himself experienced some form of this. In any event, he he ended up running away from the school and sleeping out in the wilderness, in the woods, underneath bridges, that type of thing, before making his way back to his aunt and uncle's house, where he spent Christmas of 1947. His mother, in turn, came and fetched him not long after that and brought him back to the school, from which Manson once again escaped. Some will say that it's just the rebellious spirit he had, while others, myself included, look at it as, yes, he had a rebellious spirit, but there was obviously a reason why he was unwilling to stay at that school. I doubt that it was just the fact that they were hitting the students for transgressions that led him to flee. In 1948, Manson robbed a grocery store. Some sources state that he simply did this in an effort to get food to eat, while others state that he had gone in there with the expressed desire to take more than just food. In any event, he ended up finding a cigar box that had about $100 in it, and he decided to take that as well. And with this money, he rented a room for himself on Indianapolis's Skid Row, as well as purchased food. Some sources state that Manson had a legitimate job during this period of time delivering telegrams for Western Union, and that because it did not pay him enough money, he went and restarted his life of crime. In any event, however it happened, whatever he was doing before, Manson ended up getting arrested, and he got sent to Boys Town in Omaha, Nebraska. Now, for those of you who follow any type of conspiracy theories, this is the Boys Town that the Franklin child sex abuse ring allegedly operated out of. I say allegedly because prosecutors refused to pursue the line of inquiry concerning these allegations. But there is an overwhelming amount of evidence to state that this more likely than not did happen, and that it was quieted down, much like the North Fox Island child prostitution ring in Michigan was, which anybody who's listened to the show for a while has heard me go on at length about that. Francis Sheldon, who was arrested and convicted of running a nationwide pedophile ring that had ties to both Dean Corll as well as John Wayne Gacy. This was something of that level, although it was only operating out of the Boys Town in Omaha, and it was serving a fairly high clientele list during the 1980s. There is no evidence at this point that has come out to state whether or not that type of abuse was taking place during Manson's stay at Boys Town. Even if there was, Manson didn't stay there long enough to probably experience it, because after 4 days, he and another individual by the name of Blackie Nelson were able to get their hands on a gun and steal a car, with which they went out and committed two armed robberies on their way to Nielsen's uncle's home in Peoria, Illinois. According to some sources, including Manson himself, Nielsen's uncle was a professional thief who took both boys under his wing in some kind of criminal apprenticeship. Obviously, the man wasn't that much of a master thief, however, because 2 weeks later, they were caught during a nighttime break-in of a store in Peoria, and during the investigation, Manson's ties to the two other armed robberies were discovered, and he was sent to the Indiana Boys School. The Indiana Boys School really wasn't a boys school. It was a juvenile detention center that was extremely strict and, by all accounts, exceptionally brutal. And we will get back to Manson's time there in just a moment.
From Ian Totten, best-selling author, The House of Silver Doors, The Blood Gods Trilogy, Maggie. A book which New York Times best-selling author Keith Elliott Greenberg has called a classic detective story, well-crafted, and a supernatural vortex. Maggie, the name was burned into Lieutenant Carl Jablonski's mind like a brand, and had been since the night of the fire. He doubted he would ever forget that night, or how she had danced in the flames of her burning home. Maggie, who was she, and why did no one in Kaya's Crossing seem interested in talking about her or her family? These were questions without answers, quandaries that drove Carl on as he explored the darkest of the town's secrets, desperate to unravel the knots that tied everything together. Maggie, Carl felt haunted by a visage, even as the local reporter, George Murphy, told him of the blood-soaked history that lay along their path, and the horrors that it held. None of it seemed real, and yet it was. The sacrifices, the screams, the pact with the nameless ones, and the hell that she had endured. Maggie, hers was a crime begging to be solved, and he and George are the only ones with enough heart to do it. The real question is, will they survive long enough to do it? Maggie, available 11/30/2021, in paperback and hardcover. E-book pre-orders are now available at Amazon.com. Only from Corpse Creek Publishing. You have been warned.
We are back. According to Manson, while he was at the Indiana Boys School, he was repeatedly assaulted and raped by other students slash prisoners at the school, and at least on one occasion, this was both witnessed and encouraged by a member of the staff. This is beyond believable because, by all accounts, the Indiana Boys School is a brutal, brutal place, and it was so even back then. You can find this information for yourself by simply doing a Google search of it. A lot of that different assaults have taken place there over the years. According to Manson, he ran away from the school a total of 18 times. And it was at this school that Manson developed what he termed the insanity defense, which was where, when he was faced with a situation where he could not physically defend himself, he would basically wig out and act insane until the others left him alone. Eventually, he was able to escape in February of 1951, and he did this with two other young boys, and they went on a robbery spree in their attempt to reach California. They were eventually apprehended in Utah. Again, much as the Indiana School for Boys, by all accounts, this was a fairly brutal institution. While there, Manson was given an aptitude test, and while it was found that he was illiterate, it was discovered that he had an IQ somewhere around the 109 range. His caseworkers labeled him as aggressively antisocial, which, given his upbringing to this point, I mean, honestly, you can't see how he would not be. Every adult that he'd had in his life had abandoned him and left him to his own devices. There are stories of his mother allowing her Johns to beat young Manson. I've read a couple of stories that state his mother actually let these men have sex with Manson. But again, it's Manson, so it's very difficult to shift out the truth from the fiction concerning him. Regardless, we do know he had a brutal upbringing. At this point, it's 1951. He is in this institution in Washington, D.C. He was eventually transferred to the Natural Bridge Honor Camp, which was a minimum security institution, which, considering Manson's propensity for escaping and escape attempts, is kind of astounding, especially at this period in America where we had Alcatraz, which had been instituted back in the late 1930s, just for this type of individual who were considered flight risks. And you have to think that Manson had to have it somewhere in his files about his various escape attempts and successful escapes. So the fact that they placed him inside of a minimum security prison, at least to me, is kind of mind-boggling. Through this minimum security prison, however, his aunt from West Virginia was able to visit him, and she was able to convince the prison that she would allow Manson to stay at her house and that she would help him to find a job. And apparently the prison believed this because they scheduled Manson for a parole hearing in February. However, in January of 1952, he was caught raping another boy at knife point, at which point he was sent to the Federal Reformatory in Petersburg, West Virginia. Because Manson was under the age of 21 during this period of time, they were still housing him in juvenile detention centers. Manson ended up racking up a series of 8 disciplinary offenses, 3 which involved homosexual acts. Because of this, he ended up getting sent to the maximum security reformatory in Chillicothe, Ohio. And it seems that getting sent to this reformatory did some form of good, at least for a little while, as Manson was expected to stay there until his 21st birthday in 1955. However, he managed to secure an early release due to good behavior in May of 1954, at which point it was expected that he was going to go and live with his aunt and uncle in West Virginia. In January of the following year, he married a hospital worker by the name of Rosalie Jean Willis. And to show that Manson had not reformed his way, he convinces his wife, who is by now pregnant, that they should move to California. So in July, they drive cross country in a car that Manson had stolen in Ohio. In October, Manson was arrested for the stealing of the car and was again charged with a federal crime because he took this car over state lines. He ended up receiving 5 years probation. However, this ended up getting revoked when he did not appear at a hearing for an identical charge in Florida. This coming from Vincent Bugliosi or Bugliosi in his book, Helter Skelter, which we'll get into that when we get there. Just because he said something happened doesn't mean it actually did. Especially considering the fact that Manson seems to have stayed in the Ohio, West Virginia, Indianapolis area. It's kind of a head-scratcher as to how he suddenly ended up down in Florida for a period of time and then was, boom, back into that area. And that they could tie this to him unless by this point they were seriously targeting Manson because of his list of federal crimes. And I'm unsure if at this point federal authorities were sharing the type of information such as fingerprints, etc., with state law enforcement. Although I suppose if the FBI was involved in it, they would have that information on hand. Anyways, Manson ends up getting sent to Terminal Island, which is a low-security federal prison in Los Angeles Harbor. Some of the prisoners at Terminal Island are known to have been transfers out of Alcatraz who were sent there prior to getting their releases or to finish out the remainder of their sentences. I'm going to throw some cold, hard facts at you that I learned with this year that, to me, were absolutely fascinating. Alcatraz had a much lower recidivism rate than any other federal or state prison in history. What does that mean? The majority of the convicts who were sent to Alcatraz, assuming they got out of prison, turned around and were able to lead normal, productive lives within society. That is not to say, however, that they did not pass any of the knowledge of that they learned during their criminal careers on to other convicts. And I honestly think that there is a very good chance that during Manson's incarceration at Terminal Island, that he picked the brains of a number of these individuals in order to learn not only how to be a better criminal, but also how to manipulate people. Because you have to remember, the majority of the people that were sent to Alcatraz were either A, considered a public enemy number one, B, a quote-unquote celebrity inmate such as an Al Capone or a Machine Gun Kelly, or C, were considered to be major flight risks because of their escapes and escape attempts from other prisons. And the reason I bring this up is because once Manson leaves Terminal Island, the types of crimes that he begins to get involved with escalate. I'm not talking murders and that type of stuff. That comes later, and that's another whole story in and of itself. But he begins to expand in his criminal enterprises, and I've often wondered and continue to wonder, especially after reading a book that I read concerning Alcatraz, if he was not schooled well at Terminal Island in the finer arts of being a professional criminal. While Manson was in prison, his wife, Rosalie, gave birth to a son that they named Charles Manson Jr. While he's there, his mother, who had moved to Los Angeles ostensibly to be closer to her son, and his wife would visit him regularly. However, after a period of time, Rosalie would stop visiting Manson, and he was eventually informed by his mother that she was living with another man. Shortly before a parole hearing, Manson attempted to escape by stealing a car, and he was given another 5 years of probation, and obviously his parole was denied. And here begins what I was talking about just a moment ago about the escalation of Manson's criminal behavior. In September of 1958, Manson was put on parole and given 5 years probation. During this same chunk of time, his wife Rosalie is able to secure a divorce from Manson. When Manson is released from prison, he wastes no time and begins his life anew, this time as a pimp. It's known that he was pimping at least one young girl age 16, and it's thought that he was pimping many others. He ends up getting arrested again, this time for attempting to cash a forged U.S. Treasury check. And he pleads guilty to this charge. Manson is given a 10-year suspended sentence and further probation when a young woman by the name of Leona, who was a known prostitute with a long arrest record for prostitution, comes forward and tells the court that she and Manson are deeply in love and that if he is released, they plan on getting married, which does end up happening. Some sources state that they were married to keep Leona from having to testify against him. After getting out of jail, Manson, Leona, and another young woman moved to New Mexico, which ends up getting Manson popped for violations of the Mann Act, also known as the White Slavery Act, which is a federal statute that prohibits the transportation of individuals over state lines for the purpose of prostitution. After getting released from this questioning, Manson began to suspect that the federal government was still keeping their eye on him, and he fled the area. This resulted in him getting popped on a parole violation with a bench warrant being issued, and an indictment was handed down in April of 1960 for his violation of the Mann Act. Manson ends up getting arrested in Laredo, Texas, after one of the women that he was pimping was arrested for prostitution, at which point he is returned to Los Angeles. Now Manson's in Los Angeles, got the Mann Act violation hanging over his head, so what does the federal government do? They turn around and violate his parole on the check cashing charge, and he is sentenced to 10 years in prison. During this period of time, he attempted to fight his parole violation and was eventually sent from the Los Angeles County Jail to the United States Penitentiary at McNeil Island, where it's purported that Manson took guitar lessons from Alvin Karpis, who was a member of the Barker Karpis gang, which was a gang of bank robbers back during the Depression era. Interesting side note, Karpis was at one point incarcerated at Alcatraz. We're not going to get into it this week because we're coming to the end of the show, but this period of Manson's life, the early 60s through the rest of his incarceration during the 1960s, has become something of a contentious point among Manson researchers, and I'm going to be drawing on the book Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s, to discuss this next chapter in Manson's life. A disclaimer before we get into that portion, however, and I'll do it again next week. Yes, this stuff does border on the edge of conspiracy theory. In fact, it all falls off the edge straight into it at times. However, there is massive documentation that was discovered by the author of this book, Tom O'Neill, who is a New York Times best-selling author as well as a very respected journalist, to back up what we are going to be discussing. Some of you already know some of this information. Others have never heard it. But basically, we're going to be talking about next week is the fact that there is ample evidence that shows that Manson very probably was subjected to some form of MKUltra experimentation while he was in custody at McNeil Island and afterwards. This is including when he's released from prison in Los Angeles, as well as when he goes up to San Francisco and everything that followed. Again, I'm going to attempt to put this out there in a either you believe it or you don't believe it manner, which is what I always do whenever I present something that is controversial, especially of this nature, because I don't want people to look at this show and say, oh, it's a show that promotes conspiracy theories. No, in an instance like this, where there is so much ample evidence, I want to give the information to you and allow you to draw your own conclusions as to whether or not you believe the conspiracy or not. My personal opinion in an instance like this is nobody's business, although I will give my opinion on it. Again, I want my listeners to be able to draw their own conclusions. I don't want to sway them one way or the other. So that is where we are going for the next week or two with the story of Charles Manson and the family. I am going to end this week's episode on that note because there is just so much that we have to get into in the next week that I could be here for another hour and a half just talking about what is coming in Manson's timeline. Before I leave, however, I'm going to bring back something I haven't done in a while since at least, I believe, the first season, which is I have a book of the week I'm going to recommend. It's a book that I read earlier this year. It is easily the best book that I have read all year. It is called Alcatraz, The Gangster Years by David A. Ward. If you've ever been interested in knowing truth about Alcatraz, I'm not talking, you know, the media depictions of Alcatraz, the beatings, all of that kind of stuff, but the honest to God truth about the prison and also the spin that the media put on it in an effort to get the prison to close. I cannot recommend this book highly enough. Again, it is Alcatraz, The Gangster Years by David A. Ward. That's enough from me for this week. Thank you for listening. Again, please subscribe wherever you get your favorite podcast. If you enjoy the show, enjoy what I do, please consider leaving a 5-star review. If you don't like the show, just move along. There's plenty of other true crime podcasts out there to fit everybody's needs. If you do like it, please consider sharing it on social media. Tell a friend, tell a girlfriend, tell somebody. Until next week, The Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Stay morbid.